Welcome to Family Talk with your hosts, psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, along with Ryan Dobson and Luann Crane.
Well, Dr. Dobson, I love to hear a great story, and as we're in the middle of Christmas gatherings and celebrations right now, it's a wonderful time to gather around with our own families and listen to a gentleman who communicates so wonderfully through the art of storytelling.
He certainly does, Luann. His name is Bob Stromberg, and he's one of the best storytellers I've ever heard. He currently travels as a featured comedian and speaker, and he's written a number of books, one of which is called Why Geese Fly Farther Than Eagles. What we want to do today is let our listeners hear two recorded chapters out of that book. The first is called The Miracle at Stinky Bay, and I can't wait to hear that
title.
One again. And the second is called A Father's Love. I can tell you, Luann, these are both wonderful stories.
They certainly are. We're going to get right to it and run these stories back to back, so be sure to stay tuned to hear both of them. We'll begin as Mr. Bob Stromberg narrates the story, The Miracle at Stinky Bay.
I remember when I was 8 years old, my father told my mother and my sister and me that we were going over to Aunt Martha's and Uncle Glenn's to say goodbye and to have a great trip and to catch a batch of big ones for us. Oh, it was a beautiful summer evening. The weatherman said there were many more on the way. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, the very next day, my aunt and uncle were leaving to fish in Canada. Northern Ontario, to be exact. The only place, in fact, to catch the really big ones. My uncle would say, "Why, the biggest fish we catch around here, up there, we just throw them away." And then he'd go, "Now, how big is that fish, Bobby? 12 inches? Maybe 13? Ah, throw back in. That ain't even big enough to clean." My uncle took out a tackle box that to me looked like a chest of precious treasure, filled with shiny new fishing lures and some old rusty faithful thrown in for good measure. Red rubber mice and gummy green worms that didn't look particularly realistic to me, but apparently a hungry pike isn't so apt to see those enormous hooks, and before he knows it, wham, he's posing for the camera. My aunt and uncle smiling just as big as they're able, and my cousins and I are looking at the pictures on the picnic table. Now, the fishing lures that looked like real fish, well, they were bigger than any real fish I'd ever caught, with names like the Bass Buster and the Walleyed Wonder. And then my uncle reached beneath the bottom tray and lifted out a lure that made me stare in awe. "Yeah, this one, son. This one's to catch the king of them all." I looked at a picture on the package that looked like a monster in the words, "Musky Maw." "Oh, these fish are big, son, and mean. Whoo! Take your finger clean off to the top knuckle." My father put his hand on my shoulder, kind of chuckled and said, "Yeah, Glenn, well, you got yourself 10 days to bring home the proof. We'll be waiting." And so we were. 10 days later, they drove in the drive, handshaking, hugs all around. And then my uncle, he took these three big ice chests out of the trunk, clunked them on the ground, opened them up. 1, 2, 3. No one made a sound. No one could, except to breathe a little quicker. There must have been 50 shining fish, 2 monster musky, 6 northern pike, pickerel, perch, walleye, catfish, bass, both largemouth and small, over 2 feet all, 1 northern nearly 3, others close to 4, and both musky 6-7 inches more. My uncle said, "Oh, next year, you guys gotta come. Oh, you should have seen the ones that got away. Well, you see that bass right there? Jumped right in the boat all by itself, day 4 yesterday. Oh, and look at here." And he laid a pike like a log across my forearms, all frozen and smelly. "Look at here," he said, pointing at the fish. "I snagged that one right in the belly." My father just sort of smiled and sighed, but I could see fish fever in his eyes. Oh, yeah, my dad, he was hooked like a Chinook through the gills. And before even one of those fish was grilled and eaten, my dad had had a meeting with Uncle Glenn and some other men he thought might like to go the following summer. Well, as the year progressed, I could begin to see the plans coming together, but as of yet, I'd heard no thoughts concerning me, whether I'd be allowed to go or not. Until finally in February, my father spoke to me following an evening meal. This summer you'll be 9, and your mom and I feel that's old enough, though it's going to be tough at times. Won't be easy. We'll be up early morning, probably fishing till late at night. You got to fish while the fish are biting, son. But if you think you can take it, I'd love for you to go along. And so I did. We drove all night long, so it didn't seem that far, at least not to me, curled up sleeping in the back of the car. We drove through a forest at sunrise, over a stream, parked the car right alongside, and were met by 2 young men in canoes sent to guide us to our camp cottages and their wilderness home, where we'd eat enormous breakfast and dinners prepared by their mother, Ruby, who we knew to be one of the best cooks in northern Canada. We'd pack our lunches in amongst our bait, because some of the lakes we'd be fishing were far from our base camp. I remember that first night we gathered around a kerosene lamp on a car table and looked at some maps of mostly water and some trails which would enable us to portage canoes and boats on backs over land from one lake to the next. The men drank some coffee, I had some cocoa, and then my dad and I turned in early so we'd be able to rise with the loons. And that's what we did. And I'm not kidding. That next day, we fished from early morning till late at night, and I don't think I had even one single bite. Well, once I thought I did, but it turned out to be some old roots from a lily pad, and I was really disappointed. But not my dad. He said, "Hey, tomorrow's another day. We'll get them." But we didn't. Not that day, not the next day either. We were 3 days into a 7-day trip, and except for my uncle who snagged a beaver, the rest of us had caught just about zip. Oh yeah, a couple little bony perch, and my dad caught a couple little trout, but it was nothing to write home to Mom about. I remember that night we gathered around the kerosene lamp again, and frankly, I don't think any of the men were very happy with my Uncle Glenn. He said, "Okay, I think tomorrow maybe we should stay right here and fish Clear Lake." The other said, "Fine, good." But my father said, "No, I think I'll take Bobby out through this wood and see if we can find Stinky Bay." The other said, "Fine, okay. Probably better we split up anyway." So the next day, we left at sunrise. Dad in the back, me in the bow, plenty of bait and rods and reels, and a small motor my dad could shoulder overland down into Stinky Bay. The guide had agreed to leave us a small boat and a can of gas just past a stand of pines. We were half an hour over water, twice that over land, and at 8 o'clock, just about the time I thought my legs were going to give out, we crested a knoll, and down through a hole in the leaves, we could see the sun reflecting upon our destination. It really wasn't a bay at all, but more like a pond full of lily pads and other vegetation. It was about maybe twice the size of the green in our town square. It looked like it could be full of fish. And oh yeah, my dad and I, we were the only fishermen there. So at 8:15, we threw in our first bobbers to float. 8:16, we had 2 big bass flopping right in the bottom of the boat. We couldn't believe it. We didn't even have to change our bait. Everything we threw in, they ate one after another. Wham! Pickerel! Wham! Perch! Wham! Crappie! Catfish! Bass! Big and mean! Everyone put up a fight. We knew we'd never be able to carry them all out if we fished till late at night, so we decided to keep only the very best. The rest we'd let go, even though we knew Uncle Glenn and the other men would never know nor believe we caught so many. By noon, we had the most beautiful selection of fish you could take from a Canadian lake, with the exception of the monster muskie. Each fight was a thrill, after which I'd hook the fish through the gill on a stringer and hang it over the edge of the boat, floating securely alongside. Well, about 1, the hot sun had begun to slow down things a bit. So we ate our lunches from our sacks and threw our lines for another hour or so. And then my dad said, "Well, you know, we've done so well. Maybe we ought to go." Well, my nose had begun to burn pretty bad, and I had been up since 5 in the morning. So agreeing with my dad, I reached for the stringer alongside. But wait a minute. It wasn't there. Oh, no. Wait a minute. No, the stringer was gone right over the side. Well, when did you see it last? Well, I don't know. It could have been any time over the last hour or so, maybe more. Well, what did you move it for? Well, I didn't. Maybe you did when you were looking for lunch. But it didn't matter because the stringer was gone right over the side. Somewhere in that deep water, down among those lily pads, 20 fish swam unusually close, nearly nose to nose, in fact, connected by a metal stringer through the gills, and all our thrills were for nothing because the stringer was gone right over the side. Well, for the next hour or so, my dad and I, we took turns rowing while the others searched the deep waters for a flash of fish, a shine of metal, a glimmer, a glimpse, anything to give us hope. But no, the stringer was gone, right over the side. My dad, he just sort of sat and stared. And I cried some, I admit it. And I prayed in quiet. Oh, God, could you help us get it, please, so we can show Uncle Glenn and the other men. And if you do, I'll thank you. Honest, I'll give you my allowance. I'll be a missionary. But the stringer was gone, right over the side. My dad said, hey, it's not that bad. We can fish a while, maybe catch a few. But that's not what I want to do. And besides, my dad knew it too. We'd never be able to catch a batch like we did before. And so finally, so depressed, we started into shore. I threw in my hook with a little toss. Maybe a miracle muskie sent from God would make up for the loss. But no. The hook just got hung up on another lily pad. So my dad had to row back as I reeled in till I could reach over and release the hook once again. And then this one, it wouldn't even come. The harder I pulled, the tighter it got, until finally I had such a terrible mess of line and knots, I said, Dad, why don't we just cut the line? It's just a 50-cent plug. But my dad decided he wanted to give it a tug, which he did. Muscles taut, line cutting into his finger, until finally, pop, went the root. And up came a stringer. Up came a stringer, a beautiful fish caught on my line, wrapped around that root. We let out a hoot. You could have heard it for miles around. Jumping up and down, almost tipped over the boat. My prayers had come true. And then it seemed the only right thing to do was to thank God again, which we did, this time with grateful hearts. Oh, my Uncle Glenn and the other men, they never believed. And my friends, when I told them, they just laughed right in my face. But it didn't matter. Because I'd always remember that pond like a holy place. Because something special happened that day. It was, as my dad and I say, the miracle at Stinky Bay.
You're listening to a special Christmastime edition of Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson, featuring two stories by author Bob Stromberg. Next, his short story entitled, A Father's Love.
My father held the front car door and gingerly eased me into the seat. With numb confusion, I stared at the misshapen arm cradled against my chest. It looked remarkably unlike my own. On my wrist, a large soft dent forced my discoloring fingers into a useless, atrophied shape. In my 8 long years, I'd never experienced anything quite like this. I felt no pain, but somehow I knew this to be a temporary condition. Too much information had undoubtedly shot through my nerves at the same time. All the circuits were temporarily busy, but this call would be taken by the next available agent, and at that time my arm would be given my brain's complete and undivided attention. Everything had happened so quickly. One moment I had been swinging through the high branches, and the next I was lying on my back staring up at shimmering leaves. And then I was sitting in the car gazing upon my arm as I might a broken pet. My father looked ill. How's it feel, son? He asked, slowing for even the smallest bumps. Is it hurting you yet?
No, Dad, I think it's going to be.
The sound of my own voice was like a fiber optically clear connection with the operator in my brain saying,
I'm sorry to keep you waiting. I'll put your call through right away.
Only moments before, I had actually wondered if this bent thing belonged to me. Now with each heartbeat, my arm throbbed away any doubt. Reeling, I sobbed, oh, please, Dad,
Can't you do something? Oh, it hurts so bad. I just don't think I can stand it.
The words my father spoke shocked me only a little less than the fall. Oh, son, he said, his eyes reflecting every bit of my hurt. I wish I could take the pain of that broken arm right out of your body and into my own. At that moment, with my body partly broken, my spirit was never more assured of my father's love. Though I could not understand, I believed him. Several times during later years, long after this arm and other bones had healed, I openly questioned my dad's sincerity. Ah, come on, Dad, be serious. You probably would have taken it for a few minutes, maybe give me a little rest, but you'd have given it back. But my dad never backed down. Someday, Bob, you'll understand. And what do you know? He was right. 25 years later, on a bright, late winter afternoon, his words came true. My young family and I had had the bug for about a week. In fact, it seemed like our whole little New England town had the fever. Peter Litchfield, the postmaster, said he couldn't remember a worse bout in recent times. He said he almost skipped work, which would have been the first time in nearly 25 years, and his wife told him she'd move before she'd go through it again. People in warmer climes will have difficulty understanding the severity of the spring fever. One moment you're wet with sweat longing to get outside, and the next you're shaking with chills of depression knowing you'll probably have to wait another month. To make things worse, the personality of this particular winter had created an even more oppressive strain of virus. We'd had snow the way I remembered it as a child. Drifts had swept up covering the lower panes of the first story windows, and ice a half an inch thick had covered all the trees, transforming our town into a sparkling fairyland. Unfortunately, the snow had continued to fall until the trees had had enough. All the maples lost their top branches, and many old oaks split down the middle and crashed to the ground. Now, on a bright March day, with the melted snow revealing all the casualties, our town looked like a war zone. I had the afternoon off, and recognizing that hard outdoor labor is about the best remedy for the spring fever, I decided the time had come to clean up the yard. My four-year-old was thrilled to help. Several weeks earlier, he'd been to the market with his mother and bought a plastic kite at the checkout counter. Unfortunately, he'd been unable to use it, as our lawn was for him an impenetrable jungle of branches. So we bundled up, I in my old jeans and hooded sweatshirt, and my boy in his boots, snow pants, sweatshirt, knit sweater jacket, mittens, scarf, and ear-flapped hat tied tightly under his chin. Staying on task was, for once, not a problem for my son. He knew that as soon as a large enough part of the yard was cleared, his kite would be high in the sky. An hour or so later, I tucked the molded plastic spindle handle in his fat mitten hand and shouted, "Run!" With Olympian determination, he shot across the back lawn, going about as fast as a four-year-old with 30 pounds of clothes can go. "I got it, Dad," he insisted. "You don't have to worry, I got it." Well, it was clear to me that he did, so I went back to work. And for the next hour or so, with only a few interruptions to wind in a little string or once to launch the kite again, I worked tossing branches into a burning pile on the edge of the driveway. In the late afternoon, when the wind had died down, the kite lay in the yard, the lawn was clean, and the pile had grown as tall as my shoulders, tightly packed and 8 feet across. I found a gallon of kerosene in the garage and emptied it evenly over the pile. "Hey, buddy," I called, "put the string down and come here. I want to show you something." When he was seated on the frozen ground and well back from danger, I recited our familiar family speech about matches and tossed one on the pile, which whooshed into flame. For a full hour, we sat on the ground, my arms wrapped around the child cuddled between my knees. I was aware that this was one of those rarely shared times that both my son and I would always remember. "Oh, you know what," I said. "I almost forgot that big limb from the maple behind the garage. I'll be right back. You stay away from the fire now." Hoisting the thickest part on my hip, I hauled the limb around the garage and with surprise noticed the kite shooting straight up. My son with the plastic handle back in his mitten was running across the lawn. "Dad, look," he squealed. "Quick, look, I did it again." My encouraging cheer was choked in horror as I watched my jubilant child, with his head back, eyes on the kite, and feet stumbling right toward the fire. I dropped the branch and ran with a sickening lethargy. No, stop! But it was too late. With his bare skin turned away from the heat, he passed through the warning wave and, spinning awkwardly, fell hands down on the white coals. The yellow plastic handle disappeared in a drip of blue fire as his mittens burst into yellow flame. In one reflexive, inexplicable motion, his body bounced off the fire and back on his feet. As his mother shot through the front door and I raced toward my boy, I saw in his face a numb confusion that tore at my memory. Almost with indifference, he watched black smoke pouring from his hands. Within minutes, his arms were wrapped in ice. The emergency room had been called, and we were on our way to the hospital.
Oh, Dad, it hurts so bad, he sobbed. Oh, please, can't you help me? I just don't think I can stand it.
At this very moment, as I slowed for even the smallest bumps, my father's words from long ago became prophetic. Someday, Bob, you'll understand. With a heart so full of love I thought it would break, I heard myself say the words, and more honest words I'd never spoken. Son, if I could, I would take the pain in your hands and put it right into my own.
Oh, no, Dad, he said, unable to wipe his own tears. You don't know how bad this hurts.
It doesn't matter, son. If I could, I'd take it all. I'm so thankful to say that years later, the only physical reminder of this incident is a crumpled ointment tube in the medicine cabinet. But the effect upon me is permanent. I'd often heard parents comment how God had taught them so much about himself through their children. It was one of those comments among Christian people that I felt embarrassed to question. I suppose in a general sort of way I could understand, but I would have had a difficult time enthusiastically agreeing and sharing a specific example from my own family experience. But now that was changed. From my earliest memories, I had felt God's merciful arms embrace me and his loving hand shield my face from the fire. All my life I had rested in his warm grace and beheld the hypnotic beauty of his creation. I had listened to his words and been comforted by his teaching. But carelessly, I'd avoided the awesome magnitude of his love and pain. With my face turned away and my eyes on the world, I had stumbled through life oblivious to his choking cries of warning. Now through my child, I began to understand. At least I understood enough to be able to ask the question, can it really be God? Can it really be that long ago, you personally bore my sin in your body? The question scorches my heart and I scream, no, God, you don't want to do that. It's too much. I won't let you. Can it really be, God, that you have taken all my suffering and left me without a scar? Through shameful tears that I am unable to dry myself, I hear God's words of assurance. From a heart so full of love that it was broken for me, God says, I have cleansed you from all your unrighteousness through Jesus Christ. More honest words were never spoken.
You've been listening to two beautiful stories from a talented man, Mr. Bob Stromberg, here on this Family Talk broadcast. Dr. Dobson, don't you think that the ability to tell a good story is becoming a lost art to us now?
Well, it's been squeezed out, Luann, by TV and, of course, the internet now. Storytelling has just almost gone out of style. Mm-hmm. My great-grandmother lived to be 99, and she would tell me stories of life on the frontier when she and her family were in a log cabin that mm-hmm. had been built by her father. And at night, you would hear the mountain lions creeping around outside and chasing their pigs and things. Man, I can imagine my eyes. eyes being as big as saucers as she told me those stories. Mm. But that's gone. Fortunately, it's not entirely gone because Bob Stromberg is bringing back that art. Mm-hmm. He not only tells a warm relational story, but he also makes a great application to our faith and to our love for Jesus. And of course, what could be more appropriate at this time of the year as we celebrate his birth?
If you missed either of these stories that we featured today, you can catch us online at myfamilytalk.com. While there, you'll also be able to find more information about Bob Stromberg and how you can feature his talent at your own event. Again, that's all online at myfamilytalk.com. Or if you would like a complimentary CD of today's broadcast, give us a call, 877-732-6825, 877-732-6825.
And on behalf of my wife, Shirley, and the entire staff here at Family Talk, Merry Christmas to you all.